Welcome to Interleaved, where we take a deep dive into topics from the Daf Yomi with modern-day sages of the Torah and the world. I'm Natan Ozalos-Pillay. On today's episode, a tribute to the trees.
Climate is the language that God speaks to us.
Today is Tu B'Shvat, the Jewish New Year for trees. In Jewish law, it's the first day of the new year for determining the age of young trees. And in contemporary Jewish culture and activism, it's become a sort of Jewish Earth Day and Jewish Arbor Day, rolled into one. Though Tu B'Shvat gets only a brief shout-out in Tractate Rosh Hashanah, the sages still had a lot to say about living with the earth. And living in the year 2022, it's hard to ignore the impact of climate change on our world and its inhabitants, from extreme storms to rising sea levels to devastating wildfires. So back during Tractate Tanit, we recorded an episode with someone who has immersed deeply in the wisdom of both the ancient rabbinic tradition and the newer tradition of Jewish climate activism. In honor of Tu B'Shvat, we present this special episode to you today. Rabbi Shoshana Friedman is a writer, activist, and song leader in Boston. She serves as the Director of Professional Development at Hebrew College and as a rabbinic consultant to Dayenu, a Jewish call to climate action. She is a contributing author to Rooted and Rising, Voices of Courage in a Time of Climate Crisis. Her song, The Tide is Rising, which she co-wrote with her husband Yotam Schachter, has spread as an anthem in the climate movement. Shoshana, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Natanel. It's a joy to be here.
It's so great to have you. So before we get into the Gemara, what brought you to the rabbinate? Also, what brought you to climate change activism?
I will try to answer that as briefly as I can. The answer to the second is sort of also the answer to the first. So I, from very early childhood, felt a lot of empathy with the more than human, as we say now, the more than human natural world. And it was a very overwhelming sense for me. And I was drawn to social change work and environmental activism. And as I grew up in my teens and early 20s, I tried to do that secularly. And I found it utterly exhausting. And I was spiritually and emotionally and physically burning out. So this is cutting a very long story, obviously very short, but I went to rabbinical school with the hypothesis that if I sunk my mind and heart deeply into the tradition I was raised in and born into of Judaism as a wisdom tradition, that I would be more spiritually rooted and grounded in order to do social change work. And also I would find the people that I wanted to do that work with that would hopefully turn what had become really from a very young age, a source of a huge amount of pain and isolation and despair for me, that I might be able to turn that into a place of joy and love. And in one of the most incredible, you know, Nes Gadol Haya Pod, a great miracle happened here, that happened after 6 years of rabbinical school, being really steeped in the text and in study and in community. I was blessed to go to Hebrew College in Newton, Massachusetts, where I now serve the students there. I was not able to do activism while I was in school. It was just too all-consuming. But once I got out, it was 2014, and the climate movement was entering a new chapter. And very quickly, it became clear that there were almost certainly not none. And I could, you know, there are people that I'm deeply indebted to, but very, very few rabbis who had at that point, this is now 7 years ago as we record this, who at that point had taken on the cause of climate change as something that they were really publicly speaking, putting themselves out on the streets, talking to Jews, talking to being an emissary of the Jewish community in the interfaith climate space. And I had always been called to do some kind of work that would help to heal this rift between humanity and the rest of the world that, you know, has picked up such speed and urgency in our lifetimes. And I guess I'm a big picture thinker. And so climate change is just, there are so many environmental crises, but climate change was the one that made the most sense to me as where my heart was most pulled. And so the great quote that we have to find the place where our joy and the world's great hunger meet, I found it in the interfaith climate world. And becoming a rabbi really did help give me the platform and the connections to get to do what I wanted to do and how I was called to serve, which was speaking and writing and singing and organizing.
First of all, I love that quote. That's so wonderful that you're able to find your place, you know, at the intersection of, you know, both traditions and I think both the Jewish community and the climate activism community and the world at large is really lucky and blessed to have your unique experience contribute. I'm curious if there are any like specific aspects of Torah and the Jewish tradition that kind of maybe answered those questions you had at the beginning when you were initially in climate activism.
Yeah, there's been a lot of powerful Torah that has emerged and is emerging. I should say that as I've been really delighted to serve as a rabbinic ambassador for Dayenu, a Jewish call to climate action, which is, I encourage all listeners to please check it out. It's at Dayenu, Dayenu.org. And it's an organization building a multi-generational Jewish movement to confront the climate crisis with spiritual audacity and bold political action. And it started April of 2020. So right in the beginning of this whole new chapter that we've been in with the pandemic. And I've been doing some content development for Dayenu. And so I'll share two pieces of Torah that have been really guiding for me. One is the story of Noah and how he did not say anything to protest God's decree of destruction. And are the sages contrast Noah and Abraham. Famously, they are often contrasted. And there is a chilling story. I'm just going to find the text so I can read it. There is a chilling story that is told in the Zohar Chadash in Parshat Noach. And this is a rough translation. What did the Holy One say to Noah when he came out of the ark and saw the world completely destroyed? Noah began crying and said, God, you are called compassionate. You were supposed to have compassion on your creatures. And God replied, you stupid shepherd. Now you ask me? Why did you not speak up when I told you gently what I was going to do? I spent so much time with you and spoke with you so you would request mercy for the world. But once you heard that you would be saved in the ark and the evil that would befall the world didn't impact your heart. And Rabbi Yochanan says, see the difference between the different righteous ones. Noah did not pray for his generation like Abraham did. But when God told Abraham that God would destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, Abraham stood before God and tried to save the wicked people of the city. That text answered so much for me, because the question on where do we find hope? What this tradition is teaching us is that we are actually not called upon to be successful when the odds are completely against us. We are called upon to speak out. And that is what the sages lauded Abraham for, because we have to remember that Sodom and Gomorrah are destroyed. Abraham speaks up and he has the chutzpah to challenge God and to call God on, shall not the judge of all the earth deal justly, as opposed to Noah's silence. And that has really helped me in the moments where new reports come out. You know, clearly we are not averting climate change. We are in climate change. The question now is a question of degrees. And, you know, listeners listening, like, please know every degree matters. And that's why we're still fighting. Every tenth of a degree matters. The cooler we can keep the climate, the less suffering there will be. And so we are going to keep fighting. And the odds of our grand success are infinitesimally small, but so were the odds of Abraham. And he failed, but he is lauded as a tzaddi. Our tradition says this is the way to live, is when you hear a decree of destruction, you speak out. So that piece of Torah has just been a huge machaya, a huge enlivener for me, and is one that I speak and teach about a lot. The other thing I'll just mention is this idea that is completely core to our tradition, which is that climate is the language of covenant. Climate is the language that God speaks to us. And there's other languages too, but if we look to the biblical tradition, and certainly in Ta'anit, rain in the right time is a sign that we are upholding our end of the covenant. It is how God is communicating. And there was a period that in some ways we're coming out of, I think in the late 20th century, maybe the entire 20th century, and I don't know this history intimately well, but where the more rationalist movement, and particularly in the reform movement in Judaism, was like, you know what, all this language of reward and punishment, we're just going to take that out. So most Reform prayer books that I've seen anyway, they either omit or they just have the option sort of in the back to do the second paragraph of the Shema, Deuteronomy 11, which talks about, if you obey my commandments, then I'll give you rain in the proper times and you'll have enough food. And if you don't, you're going to perish from the good earth that God has given you. And so y'all should do these things. And there's this rationalist stance that's like, you know what, that's too much like a God interfering with nature. We don't believe that anymore. We also, like, we don't believe in that kind of divine reward and punishment or in that kind of cause and effect. Well, the ancients believed it. And it turns out that we are now living in an era where that is literally like the pshat. That is the basic meaning of the text. What we do is literally impacting the rain. And it is phenomenal to me how biblical these times are that we're living in, and that we can actually look to these texts to see them as speaking directly to us. But also, instead of finding that terrifying, I personally actually find it in a strange way comforting, which is to say that this is a sign of God's love. Like, it's complicated to talk about because in a human relationship, you know, you would never say that punishment is a sign of love, like God forbid, that's abusive. But there's something about the theology of the Bible says that when bad things befall us, like drought, it is not a sign that God has abandoned us. It is a sign that God is in communication, trying to give us the tochacha, trying to give us the rebuke so that the relationship can be mended. And when I can see climate change like that, I actually feel in closer relationship with God and I feel a little bit less despair.
Wow, that was incredible. Just so incredible. Thank you for that. I had like a similar kind of revelation, not to the same extent. So thank you so much for like expounding on that. That was just a beautiful drasha or exposition. Just like thinking about Parshat Bereishit, the midrash that says that God didn't bring rain until Adam prayed for it, which is kind of also communicates that we pray and God brings the precipitation or the climate. And I'm also so happy that you brought that Zohar Chadash. So powerful and moving. Actually, I read it on your website, reading that drasha, that sermon that you gave. I was blown away by it. So thank you for sharing that. Let's dive into the daf. On the first page of the tractate, Rabbi Yochanan makes a well-known agadic statement. God alone has the keys to three natural or supernatural phenomena, and God doesn't give access to these keys to any messengers. The three things, childbirth, the resurrection of the dead, and rainfall. In context, Rabbi Yochanan's statement follows a discussion of how God demonstrates God's might through controlling rainfall, and how the weather is so dependent on human prayer. But the statement reminds me of a central problem in climate activism. Often it appears that the few people who hold the keys to change, namely politicians, either aren't willing to even talk about climate change or aren't willing to take definitive action on it. Even voting for politicians with climate justice agendas can only go so far if, when it comes down to it, they aren't willing to put their money where their mouth is. As an activist yourself and a leader of other activists, how do you maintain faith in the face of such a problem?
Yeah, it's a big one. And I appreciate your take on the text. I think, first of all, I want to point out, it's such an incredible statement about these keys to childbirth and resurrection of the dead and rain. And one thing that is perhaps obvious, but worth saying is it makes it clear what a gigantic deal rain is in our tradition. And this is something that is really important for us to remember. And I think a really big part of the Jewish climate Torah and what we are learning as a people and as a movement right now, that we're reclaiming in many ways the centrality of an agrarian awareness, which is to say a specific awareness of a particular place and then the meteorological weather needs, the soil needs, the seasonal needs of a particular place. And for our ancestors, of course, that was the land of Israel or Babylon, but our places also have those kinds of needs. And we can feel very separate and insulated from drought or from flood if we are not in a place being directly impacted by either of those things. And obviously those are getting more and more common, but actually we're talking about life and death here. I mean, that's what that statement says to me, right? When we're talking about rain in our tradition, in a land that was grown out of a land that is utterly dependent on rain because we did not have any major rivers. Israel does not have major rivers. Like, that's our civilization comes out of that. And it's so important for us to remember. There's a line I'll read that was in an essay. It feels a little bit bizarre to quote myself, but I'm just going to do it because it says what I want to say. Nothing but sweeping systemic policy change will make a difference at the scale we need. And nothing but massive organized social movements have ever accomplished such reforms. That's the answer that I want to offer to your unanswerable, of course, question. Like the power systems are skewed in horrible ways. We're living in oligarchy where corporations have insane amounts of power. Your listeners know that. But it's important to remember that actually what moves the dial is almost never the politician. It's always the people pressuring the politician. And we are in a situation where even that system, and especially in the States, our democracy is in so much peril right now. And it is still true that these kinds of sweeping reforms are not in the hands of those who hold the seats of authority. It's in the hands of the massive numbers of people making calls, showing up in the streets, writing, talking to their friends, putting their bodies on the line to block infrastructure. That's actually what holds the key to change. And it may not, you know, going back to the Noah and Abraham, like it may not be successful in the ways that we want. Certainly it won't be in every fight. It may not be even in most fights, but part of the work is to redefine hope and to understand that we're part of a massive immune response that the planet is having. And that in itself is sacred. That in itself is worthy. That in itself is beautiful. And even if we don't get the right reins in the right time, we're standing up for what's right. And there's tragedy there, of course, and there's also real beauty.
That's such a invigorating perspective on hope and, you know, what it takes to accomplish real change. So thank you. And it reminds me of a statement on 8A where Rabbi Ami says, "Rain only falls because of Baalei Amana, or masters of faith." And in communicating that message, I think you really embody that, master of faith in people, someone who has a realistic idea of how to accomplish change and what hope is, and how to have hope that's and faith that's sustainable and can keep one going instead of burning out. And of course, you know, burning out is okay too.
totally. And I, you know, if there's anything that the last 7 years of finally, finding really my stride as an activist was only 7 years ago. And it's that there are cycles and mm-hmm. we're not in this alone. And I have to remind myself that every single day. And I think a lot about playing soccer as a kid and how, when we're really little and we're playing soccer, we all run after the ball at once. And I can still hear my dad's voice. You know, I'm 7 years old. I can hear my dad's voice. Play your position. You're a herd of elephants stampeding after a ball. Just play your position. And by the time I was, you know, 10, 11, 12, I had learned how to play my position in soccer. And the beauty of being part of a team where I had my eye on the whole field, but I knew where I was meant to be. And that's how we would win games. And it's also how it would feel like being in a flow state of that, like the joy of that kind of work of team sports. And honestly, I think that's some of the best spiritual preparation I've ever had for activism. I've never said this out loud, but it feels really true. And because for most of the first couple decades of my life, as I spoke about feeling isolated and burnt out, that was sort of me being part of that herd of elephants, seven-year-old kids clamoring to all kick the soccer ball. And becoming a wiser human being for me has really looked like learning to play my position. And that also means taking my cues from the coach who knows my skills. And in my coach is my higher self, my husband, God, therapist, but it's like, what is mine to do? I got to play my position and I can't do it all. And that's also a really invigorating message, because I think so many of us think if I can't save it, it's not worth trying. And the truth is you can't save it, but you can play your position in a really massive and beautiful movement.
Such an apt analogy. Really speaks to me too. So the Mishnah on 10a rules that if rain does not fall by the 17th day of the month of Mar Cheshvan, the Yichidim, or singular individuals, begin to fast a series of three fasts. The concept of the Yachid is a fascinating one that raises a number of questions. Who were these Yichidim? How did they become Yichidim? Who decides who is and who is not a Yachid? And in preparing this daf for our conversation, my mind immediately went to climate change and justice activism. If you stop a random person on the street and ask them to name a climate change activist or a climate activist, they might be able to name Greta Thunberg, but that's about it. And yet there are so many people doing essential work and making Herculean efforts for the movement and for the entire planet that we simply don't hear about. And I think this ties to what you're just talking about, finding your place within the team, within the greater collective. Is there a corollary to the Yachid in the world of climate activism? And do you think it has a place in the work that you do?
It's such a great question. And I've been sitting with this question of Yachid now for over a year. I guess I have two thoughts on it. One is, when I first read the Mishnah, I really identified with that Yachid. And I hope not in a in an arrogant way, I really hope that comes across, but as someone who has felt this for decades. Like, my first take when I read that Mishnah is, the Yachidim are the people who go, oh, it's not raining. That's a real problem. And maybe other folks haven't. I mean, this is an agrarian society, so likely people noticed. But maybe other folks aren't quite alarmed yet. Or maybe they're really busy with the rest of their lives and they haven't sort of noticed the writing on the wall that like something's going on. And the Yachid is the person who feels it and feels it early. And that was the first way that I felt this Mishnah. And I really identify as someone who has lived with this sense of foreboding, having chronic recurring dreams of ecological disaster when I was a child and no one else saw it coming except me. I just felt very isolated and there was a lot of pain there. And in that regard, a lot of the healing, I think for those of us who have found ourselves on sort of that end of awareness, a lot of the healing is getting out of that Yachid mentality, that individual mentality, and finding ourselves part of something bigger where actually billions of people are now aware and millions are activated, maybe billions are activated. The other way that the Yachid, and I think this is more what you're asking, that I think the concept of Yachid functions is saying like, the way it's understood is, and I can't remember the sage who said this, but essentially somebody who's learned it in Torah, a Yachid is someone who's learned it in Torah and worthy of being a teacher and a leader. And that's how many of the commentators read it. And so in that regard, I think that there are, first of all, there's a lot of discussion in the Masechet Ta'anit about whether it's appropriate to take on the status of Yachid. And ultimately, I really like the idea that that yes, it is. And there is debate about it, but that yes, it is okay. And because you're doing this for a righteous reason and because it's not for your own glory. My sense is that there are a lot of people in the world right now who are transitioning from being part of the Sibur in this Mishnah, the people who are not quite yet feeling like they're taking leadership or that this is really their problem yet, and that people are transitioning into the sense of being a Yachid, someone who's really wrestling with the issue of climate change and who is figuring out what is their role to play and who is sort of standing up or making some kind of personal move to commit to playing their position in the movement. And then I do think that there is a role for folks who are holding a sort of collective consciousness about it and who are helping the community to metabolize grief and to express our feelings and our thoughts and to feel unstuck as much as possible. And I think that role is really, really important. And certainly there are the Yachidim who have taken on massive, massive amounts of leadership. I think about the Sunrise Kids or you know, somebody like Rabbi Jenny Rosen, who founded Dayenu and who sort of had placed herself as, I'm a social justice person, not an environment person, for much of her life, and then like woke up to the crisis. Oh, and her answer was, okay, I think I need to found an organization, because actually as robust and beautiful as the Jewish environmental movement is, no one's doing this systemic power building work in the climate space in the Jewish community, and I'm going to step up and do it. I mean, that's a Yachid move. I guess I'm trying to say two things at once. One is that there is a role for the community leaders who are in some way committed at a different level, and that isn't going to be everyone. And I think there is also room for every single person to play around with, what does it mean for me to be a Yachid? What does that kind of wrestling with the Torah, being a leader in my own sphere, pushing myself out to other spheres, what does that look like for me?
Thank you for that. So well put. I think society has a prejudice or a preconceived notion of climate activists as like doomsayers, or I don't know what the word is, doomsday people, I don't know.
It's very aptly, it's a Jeremiah. It's like, yeah. I don't want to hear from you because all you're saying is everything's bad.
Yeah.
It's that prophetic, the really hard prophet voice that no one really wants to hear.
On 11a, the Talmud cites a number of statements from sages and then a Baraita about the value of feeling the pain of the community or even the entire Jewish people when they are in the midst of suffering. Today, we might call this empathy. But for the Talmud, simply feeling empathy is not enough. One has to literally make themselves suffer, litza'er atzmo, whether by not eating during a famine, even if one has food, or by abstaining from other pleasurable activities. The history of activism in general is rife with examples of people sacrificing their own pleasure and well-being for the sake of the greater good, whether through sit-ins, long marches, or protests where the possibility of police brutality or the brutality of other governmental agencies is very real, like you said, people putting their bodies on the line. But for people who are not involved in climate justice activism, it can be difficult to summon this empathy, especially if one does not live near an area affected by or at risk of being affected by climate change. How can we cultivate empathy for people, especially people in the global south, whose very lives are threatened by rising sea levels and pollution and so many other factors, when we can't actively put our bodies on the line? I think, you know, a lot of people will say, hearing about climate change and climate activism, like, oh, that's not for me. Like, I can't do that. That's too intense. Is there something else that a kind of person like that can do?
So I want to say two things. The first is a funny secret that I learned when I started doing this work is that I have never tapped into the kind of joy and fulfillment that in almost any other area of my life, except probably my own family life and the meaning that I draw from parenting and being married to my husband and, you know, the people I love. But sort of outside of that, getting to serve as part of the climate movement has been a source of some of the most tremendous fulfillment and meaning and joy in my life. And that is a weird thing to say, because I absolutely would do anything possible to make us not in this insane, horrific situation that we're in. But I also try to really like push back against the narrative that this is egregiously difficult, because it is egregiously difficult. And there are people who get deeply hurt. There are people who are killed, who are assassinated in this movement. I mean, that is unspeakably horrible. And getting to be part of something so huge and so meaningful is itself a source of a comfort and joy. And this is what Joanna Macy teaches in her work around what it takes to get to what she calls the great turning, what she calls active hope. We are actually most miserable when we're isolated in our own pain. And so finding some way to contribute to the movement actually tends to give people more energy than saying, I don't have time, I don't have energy, but I'm really freaked out. So that's one audience. Like, that's one, the people who are already really want to help and just feel like I can't, I'm scared of it. A lot of what I try to offer is like, find what you love, find your deep gladness. Do you love working with kids? Do you love doing art? Do you love speaking? Do you love spreadsheets? Actually, the movement needs everybody's skills. And there are groups that could use that. And there are, if you're listening to this as a Jew, check out dayenu.org. If you're a young person under 35, check out Dayenu or check out Sunrise, Mothers Out Front. There are phenomenal organizations that can help, or a Blockadia protest near you. And that it doesn't actually take uprooting your whole life to do something meaningful. I always thought it did. And those are some of the most incredible yechidim out there, the folks who really do uproot everything. But it doesn't actually require that for you to meaningfully contribute to the movement. The other thing I want to say is, and this has been really real for me as a mom of a really young child, is giving money, even if you're in a position to give anything, and most of us are in a position to give even some small amount that could feel big to you, giving money to the right climate organizations is actually incredibly effective kind of a way to contribute. And so for those where time or political action feels scary, but you have some tzedakah budget, really consider effective climate organizations. Second part of the answer, or my thoughts on this, for the folks who are having trouble summoning the empathy, I think I have two thoughts. One is for people who are really, really like, don't believe in it, aren't concerned about it, I honestly don't waste my time. Gig is it. You're going to live your life. I'm not going to knock on your door. You know, I was a canvasser for a summer. You don't waste time with the folks who shut the door in your face. You just go on to the next house. There are enough people who are really freaked out and want to find a place in the movement. I'm going to focus on them. For the people who are like, hey, this is a problem and I feel it in my head, but I actually feel numb. And that's the more common manifestation of what you're talking about. And for them, I would really point to Joanna Macy's work. And Dayenu has some spiritual adaptation workshops that are unfolding around the country. This is the work of actually the really hard, beautiful, incredibly real work of feeling our own grief. And I am blown away by the sections of this Masechet that speak so concretely to what we are wrestling with right now. This idea that if we don't let ourselves in on the suffering of the community, we also will not be part of the consolation. What? That is so wise. And the way I read it is, if we don't let ourselves connect through our pain to other people who are hurting, to feeling the pain of the habitats around us, of other species, if we don't have a good cry, if we don't journal, if we don't talk to somebody and like let ourselves emote it in our bodies. And I don't mean just think it, because that's not the kind of, that's not where healing tends to happen. And we all do this differently. For me, it's cathartic crying and writing. For you, it might be jogging and talking to a friend. But if we don't actually like feel it in our bodies, we're stuck not feeling it at all. And it's really hard to explain, but I deeply believe from my own lived experience, this is true, that the not feeling it at all is actually more painful than the feeling it, that the numbness is actually worse. And that feeling grief in a clean way, or talking to other people who are scared, like letting ourselves feel connected through the pain, which is what I really hear Ta-Anit saying, that's the way to find the consolation. That's at least what Joanna Macy teaches. And I found it to be true personally.
Wow. Wow. That was incredible. I just love how you brought that idea of like, Kol Hamita Be'al Yushalayim Zohavara V'Sim V'Simchata, like you have to really feel the pain in order to feel the comfort. But, and also the fact that the numbness feels worse. I feel like numbness is also what I see more than just outright denial. On 22a, the Talmud tells a well-known story of Rabbi Broka Hoza, who often received visions of Elijah the prophet in the marketplace. One day, Elijah pointed out two men walking in the market and told Rabbi Broka that they were destined for the world to come. Why? Because they were jesters, and they used their sense of humor to cheer up the downtrodden and make peace between people who are in conflict. For me, the story demonstrates how highly our tradition values even the briefest and seemingly insignificant movements of kindness and compassion towards other people. And I know that kindness and compassion is what motivates you and so many others to fight against climate change. But that must be so difficult to communicate when the message you must spread is one that is so urgent and scary. How do you balance the doomsday urgency with optimism and inspiration? And how do you inspire hope in people who believe climate change cannot be stopped or slowed down?
Well, climate change can't be stopped, as far as I know. We are trying to slow it down. So if you are scared, you are paying attention. I have started to play around with the word adventure. I've been thinking about the great myths, the Exodus story, the Lord of the Rings, Star Wars, so many, you know, the hero's journey across traditions, all the wonderful young adult novels that we fall in love with, science fiction and fantasy. It's full of the story of folks waking up to a threat, saying, I can't do it, I'm too scared, finding the guides and the teachers and the strength within themselves and doing it. This kind of narrative lives in our subconscious. It lives in our dreams. It lives in our stories. It lives in the Bible. It lives all over. And we are in it right now. We are in it as a species. And it is frightening as all hell, and it is tragic as all hell. And it is also a huge adventure. It's life-threatening. People are dying. I'm not trying to glorify it. I don't want to sugarcoat it. It is just another way to see something really scary. This is an unknown journey I'm going on, and we're all going on it together. And when I place myself in that story, the one where scary things are coming, but I have people with me, I have the earth with me, I have God with me. A lot of my spiritual practice has to do with connecting with trees. I have the trees with me. I have the love that I have been blessed with from my family that ultimately in my spiritual life does not come from those people themselves, but is a representation of a cosmic love that flows through them. When we have those of us who are blessed enough to have experienced love in our lives, which I really hope is everyone. And I know, of course, some folks, that's a much harder word. That love is there for us as we go through this. And I've been trained as a chaplain. My mother is a hospital clown. And when I think about this part of Ta'anit, I think about her and I think about the work that she and her clown troupe have done and are just now again getting to start doing as I'm recording this. The pandemic obviously shut that down a bit. And I got to do it with her for a year or two. I also volunteered. And this is work of going into a hospital where there are really sick kids and showing up at the door of that hospital room and bringing your full heart and your full presence to that child and seeing them for the full soul ensouled being that they are, and not as a cancer patient, not as someone there, you know, because of an accident or an illness. And the children light up and it is the most beautiful meeting of souls. And I think about these gestures and the state that we are in now, that it requires that kind of radical presence and that kind of radical presence to the earth's pain, to each other's pain, beautiful. And actually it's so joyful. And you can have, like, there can be a child who is really sick in a room who is also really happy because there's a moment of connection where someone is entering the space and seeing them in their fullness and in their gorgeousity of their soul. And like, the earth is beautiful. The earth is gorgeous. The earth is alive. She's going to be alive, climate change or not. And we can be present to that aliveness. And just like you were saying, Natanael, around being, noticing the space around where we live in terms of climate crisis, we can also notice where we live in terms of beauty. And we can get to know, I mean, my big thing is getting to know the tree species. That's my way in, but everyone can have their own way in to getting to know the biome around them, the ecosystem around them, and being present to it. And by that, I mean, like, go on a walk without your earbuds in. Get to know, this again sounds so cliche, but it's really, really helpful. Get to know one tree and don't just tap into what you can see. See if you can, like, open your senses and feel the tree's roots under you and how far they go. There's a Norway maple in our backyard who is giant, and he takes up, like, just shelters our whole yard, shades our house. And I have started to really, like, lean on him physically, but also, like, I feel into his presence if I'm having a hard time falling asleep or if I'm feeling anxious, and I can feel him holding me. Like, I have a relationship with this tree, and that's that gesture moment. I think it's a moment of presence, of being, like, radically present to the pain and to the life that is actually there, even though there is pain.
Wow. I'm out of words to describe how, like, moving this Torah is for me, being aware of what's around you and also being able to lean on it, to lean on them and develop a relationship with them. For me, it's birds. I'm a birder, and it's been a while because of all work and stuff, but yeah, it's that radical presence. Yeah, I love that. I'm not going to read this story in the same way because of the way you described it, radical presence. Thank you. Another story on 24A tells of a school teacher who merited to have his prayers for rain answered because of the deep care and sensitivity he showed to his students. That care and sensitivity is so important when we talk to kids about scary things like climate change. How do we talk to young children about climate change?
Yeah, this is one I think about a lot. And I want to give the caveat that I'm not currently in a role of really talking to children other than my son about matters of substance. I have been in that role. I've been a teacher and I've been a pulpit rabbi where I've worked with kids, and I'm not in that role currently. So I really want to honor those who are, like, actually doing that work. So, and I think I'll just focus on what I've been doing with my son, because that's what I can really speak to right now. He's only 4, and I've introduced him to the word climate change when he was 2, and it was gut-wrenching for me. And so the first thing I want to say is that I would really recommend that those who are working with kids or who are parents, if you haven't yet, like, start doing your own work around the grief and the fear, because your kids are going to be doing their own work. And the more you've gone a few steps ahead of them, the more you can hold them in their process. So that's one thing. The other thing is, I am incredibly passionate. I have a big soapbox around the language of "you can change the world," because it really didn't serve me as a kid, because that language is wildly ambiguous. Who's the you? What kind of change? What world are we talking about? I heard it as, you should save the world, and if you do everything right, you will be able to. which is a terrible message to give to a kid, but kids will misunderstand things. And so I really stay away from that kind of language. And instead, when I'm talking to Abraham, my son, I give the very, very basics of the science. And I don't, I should say, I don't like initiate, I'm not like, let's talk about climate change. I bring it up. I give it the word if it's relevant. So he asked what the stickers were on the back of our car. And I have sunrise stickers, sunrise bumper stickers for the sunrise movement. And I say, it's a sticker for a group of people saying that I support a big group of people who are working to help with the problem of climate change. What's climate change? The earth is getting warmer. Why? Well, people are burning things called oil and gas, and it puts a gas into the air that is like a blanket around Mama Earth, and she's getting warmer. And then I always say, but there are so many people working on this problem. There are so many grownups who know about it and who are working so hard all over the world. And that's the part where I always like tear up, because that's what I didn't feel as a kid. And that's what was so freaking scary. And I know I'm not alone in having had that experience as a child, but we were kids in a time where there wasn't the kind of global movement there is now, but people knew it was, we knew the crisis was coming, but we didn't have the movement. And if there's one thing I can say that's good about the time we're living in around climate change, because the climate change itself is horrible, it's that we've gotten to the point where people are awake. I'm not talking about the denier, like I have no time for them, but we have huge numbers of human beings, like every other country in the world, you know, there's no other country in the world that has a major political party that denies climate change. So everyone else gets it. And it doesn't mean we're going to be successful in averting the worst. Maybe we're still fighting like hell for that. But it does mean that today's children are growing up in a world where they are not alone. And there are massive movements of kids and teenagers who are mobilized. And so my biggest prayer for children is that we can, well, my biggest prayer for children, of course, is that we can avert the worst of climate change. But in terms of their lived experience, it's that they can feel a sense of connection to the movement so that they do not have to have layered on top of the concern about storms or fires or droughts, you know, depending on where they live, they should not also have the concern that no one is paying attention. And they should not also have the sense that it's on them to save the world. It's not. That's ridiculous. And I know that's how many, many, many people, young people feel, because folks who are older don't get it in the same way, because their lives aren't impacted in the same way. The other thing I want to say about climate change is that I talk to Abraham about death. I talk to him about it early and often. And that is part of my really intentional spiritual preparation for him to live in a world with an unstable biosphere. I don't want him to be afraid of the concept of death. So from a very young age, I think about 2 years ago, we started, you know, noticing decomposition, decomposing leaves. We talk about, we had two hemlock trees in our backyard who were sick with the woolly adelgid hemlock blight. And at 2 years old, Abraham cried with me about those trees needing to be taken down. And we talked about the trees returning to Mama Earth. And my language for him about the earth is always Mama Earth, because he calls me Mama. And I want him to feel held in that same way by the earth, and that he belongs to her, and that she is also his mother. And I do really believe that that helps with the spiritual adaptation. I see him growing up, please God, with a sense of belonging and a sense that he is beloved here. And that is hugely important. And I think needs to be like the bedrock, because it is so easy for kids. And this was my experience as a child anyway, of like, I'm just polluting, I'm consuming. Like I shouldn't even have been born, because the earth just doesn't need more people. And, you know, it's a whole other podcast around population, the choice to have children and all that. I'm working on a writing piece about it right now. But the most important thing for a child who is born is to know that they are beloved here and that the earth loves them. And the line that I use for Abraham around death is that his soul goes back to God, and that our souls go back to God and our bodies go back to Mama Earth. You pick whatever works for you and your family. That's sort of my theology and cosmology. And it really works for me. And it seems to work for him, because he can see that the leaves do go back to the earth. And we practice that in our garden. We don't rake up the leaves that fall on the garden beds. I'm very lucky not to have a lawn. So I just rake up the leaves that are in the way of the walkways, and the rest of the leaves compost and they become part of the soil. And like, honestly, I think that doing gardening with your children is probably one of the best ways to start talking about climate change, simply because you can start talking about life and death and nutrient cycling and the fact that we all belong to the earth. And the climate change as a topic, when we think about it globally, is so huge and so scary, and climate change science and all that. And that's important. Like, we need to give the kids the basics. And of course, as a child gets older, they need to learn more of the science. But for really young kids, I really think grounding in the cycles of life and death around trees, around insects, if you see a dead animal, not shying away, but talking about it and talking about how the animal died and that their body will go back to the earth, that to me is all part of talking to him about climate change.
Wow. I can't think of a better way to end. That's really inspiring to me as a father myself. Our son is too, moving me to think more deeply about these things and to introduce him more. Rabbi Shoshana Friedman, thank you so much.
It's been a real pleasure, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to articulate things that are on my mind a lot and to get to share them with your listeners.
Between episodes, you can keep up with Interleaved on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you heard, follow us, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, and share this with your friends. Special thanks to our executive producer, Adina Karp. Come back next time for another deep dive.